Good morning. How much progress has Hawaii made to counter homelessness? Today we get a status report from someone we spoke with last year during our series on homelessness. Katie Miller of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness joins us today, and we'll focus on the Fed. UHERO Director Carl Bonham explains what's up with inflation, because it's not inflation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
I'm Bill Sage. Before there was Hamilton, there was 1776. It won Tony Awards a generation before the man whose face is on the $10 bill hit Broadway. Polycule Theater's Tom Holowak brings it to the stage. And we'll hear how a father's incredible storytelling on a tiny Pacific island inspired his son to pass on that enthusiasm. The proof's in the work at the Ohina Short Film Showcase. We'll talk with filmmaker Filisone Heronico later this hour.
That's the conversation for this last day of August. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. This is The Conversation. And to my right, I am looking at a Bill Sage who's sitting in for Chris Vandercook over the next couple of weeks. Good morning.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here on this breezy day in paradise. But, you know, it might get a little bit breezier and that could be really rough on the homeless, couldn't it?
Well, this is true. And looking at some of the encampments that we saw even coming in this morning. Now, remember about a year ago, we devoted a week to finding out how other cities were working to end homelessness, or at least mitigate it substantially, and what Hawaii might learn. One of the people we spoke with was Katie Miller. She's a regional coordinator on the National Initiatives Team at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. She's in Honolulu this week, and since our original conversation, we wondered how she is assessing Hawaii's progress and ongoing challenges. Katie Miller is in our studio. Welcome back.
Thank you, Beth Ann. I'm so glad to be here with you today.
Good to talk to you. Now, since we were originally speaking about a year ago, there's been a lot that's happened, a lot that at least has made headlines, and certainly we've seen all the proclamations from the governor starting last October during the legislative session, $12 million cut toward homeless initiatives, and a lot more than the governor had expected. But as you look at it from the outside in, what do you see as you look back at Hawaii?
Sure. I'm actually really excited by what I'm seeing here on the ground. I feel like there is movement since I was here a year ago. As we talked about, then we've talked about a number of different strategies that needed to come into play to make progress here in Hawaii. And I believe that the governor's proclamation, the state of emergency on homelessness, was a great tool that he used to help create some of that momentum. And really, that was about getting money out quickly and creating housing units and housing opportunities as fast as possible. So as we near the end of that emergency proclamation, really that momentum needs to continue. And the folks in Hawaii need to continue to work together, strengthen those partnerships to leverage resources and drive towards that housing first model, moving people quickly into permanent housing.
You bring up housing first. That's a term that we haven't heard a lot of this year. I mean, we talked a lot about it last fall, but then it seemed to ebb from consciousness, even though very clearly that's HUD's driver. How do you see that sinking with getting federal monies or threats to federal money and what you see happening within Hawaii with the money that we're generating?
Sure. And I haven't heard it a lot, but I have seen the action that is a housing first approach, which is the money that the governor released around the state of emergency really has been about getting people into housing quickly. Resources have gone out for what we call rapid rehousing, which is moving people quickly to permanent housing. The challenge here is affordable housing. So as you know, we have an affordable housing crisis here in Hawaii. We need more units of affordable housing, and it's very challenging to end homelessness unless we have a place to move people quickly. And so that, as part of the state's framework on homelessness, is one of the areas that's been identified. 10,000 units be created by 2020. And to do that, it's going to take everyone working together with urgency to create those units and make sure that they're truly affordable for those people that are most vulnerable.
It's sometimes difficult to maintain that sense of urgency over time. People get tired, fatigued. This is certainly an issue that fatigues a great many people for a great many reasons. But in being able to have the tenacity to see that strategy through, because you're talking about, you know, over the next 4 years or so, that could be problematic, especially as you mentioned, you know, momentum that will come to an end with this last proclamation of the governor. Is there a different way of approaching this that you think that we need to employ, or something that will help to keep that urgency and that momentum driving forward?
That's a really good question, Beth Ann. I attended the State Interagency Council on Homelessness meeting on Monday, and part of that meeting was to adopt a state framework on ending homelessness. It's really important that everyone have a clear framework, a clear plan, so that everyone is paddling in the same direction. We not only is it about the state plan, but at the local level, it's really critical that we set clear goals and each other, everyone hold each other accountable. So not only is it about the state framework, it's about the detail underneath that that really drives towards action. And as I talked to that group on Monday, they need to see where they work together as state agencies, as nonprofits, and as business community to really set clear goals and action that drives towards creating the 10,000 units and really ending homelessness for people in Hawaii.
The way you've just said that, it seems as if there's some real disconnect among those groups and perhaps with the city too in the overall framework. I hear you say that all of this really needs to be streamlined and that these groups need to be talking more to each other, which probably, you know, seems pretty logical to a lot of other people listening to this, but hasn't really been happening as much as it has, say, in the last, you know, just couple of years. What more do you want to see happen, very specific things that would mean that all those groups, the business community, the city, the state and its agencies, and other nonprofits, that would be better aligned so that they can be moving forward with alacrity and also with a sense of unity?
Sure. I think that there has been greater communication since I was here a year ago. I am seeing the city and the state and the counties working together, and everyone is in agreement and understanding what the mission is. Again, the conversation around Housing First, there is a true belief around Housing First, but the housing is going to be critical and the creation of housing. And so when you ask me what that number one thing is, it's really, it's in order to develop housing that's truly affordable, it's going to be critical that everyone work together to ensure that resources are working together, that everyone's goals are lined up so that units can come online quickly. It's important that if we have separate priorities, we're moving in different directions, that that ability to create units quickly won't happen. And so really packaging those resources, thinking about the federal resources, the state resources, the local resources, and how we can align those goals together. And that is one thing I talked about on Monday, that in those communities where we see the most progress, we have alignment at the federal, the state, and the local level.
And that includes the business community and the development community. What when you're talking about, as we have talked about before, an area where you have finite land that has great value, the incentives, and we've talked about this with the city before and with the mayor, but keeping those incentives top of mind so that it might be more attractive for someone to also build, a developer to also build, you know, low-level units that are not going to get them top dollar, but that would be providing a public service.
Absolutely. And I think that the business community is really interested to engage, and I think the developer community is interested to engage, but we need to have a clear roadmap where everyone understands what their role is and how we work together.
And how close to that roadmap are we now?
I believe we're heading in that direction, and the state is working on that. And again, on Monday, the state framework was adopted. And then from that, my hope is that the detail will come out, and at the local level, we'll begin to create real action steps for each county in Hawaii.
I'll look forward to talking to you more about that in the future, and thanks for coming back this time.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Katie Miller is a regional coordinator on the National Initiatives Team of the Interagency Council on Homelessness. She bridges the work of the full council and states, including Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, Oregon, Nevada, Washington, Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota, too.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's 8:14 coming up. Ohino for the ohana, but first, a little baseball in the backyard quiz.
New York's Main Endwell brought home the championship last Sunday, winning the Little League World Series, beating South Korea 2-1, giving New York its first title since 1964. So with a little baseball on the brain, today's backyard quiz has us digging through old team rosters, looking for a right-handed player who was born in Honolulu in 1960, grew up in Millbury, Massachusetts, and found professional success on the pitching mound. Early in his collegiate career, in his second year as a Bulldog at Yale, he set Yale's record for single-season batting average. He is best remembered as the starting pitcher for the amazing Mets from 1983 to 1991. Career highlights include being one of the select few chosen for the 1985 All-Star team, helping his team win the 1986 World Series Championship. For today's quiz, can you name this mystery player? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the T-shirt.
I am Hakim Belabbes. I'm a Chicago Moroccan filmmaker, and you're listening to the conversation on HBR2, member supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Ohina means gathering or collection, and the Ohina Short Film Showcase provides Hawaii's independent filmmakers with a chance to gather both their films and the local community. Professor Wilsoni Heriniko of the University of Hawaii's Academy for Creative Media and three of his students produced film screening in this Friday's festival, and he joins us in studio. Aloha, Vili. How are you today?
Aloha. And bula.
Bula. That's right. That's how's it Fijian style, correct?
Yes.
Now, you were born in Rotuma, is that correct?
Correct.
Which is actually part of Fiji, which is Melanesian, but it's Polynesian, right?
That's right. It's all the fault of the British. They lumped Rotuma with Fiji because we were easier to administer that way.
But growing up on an 18-square-mile island, it was, as a right. child, you got a lot of your inspiration and creativity from your father's stories?
Yes, my father was a great storyteller, and I was very fortunate because on moonlight nights, he would take the kids outside. There were 11 of us, and he would tell us the myths and the legends of the island. So from that very early age, I became very aware of the transformative power of a great story. And interestingly enough, that sustained me throughout my life, and now I teach at the Academy for Creative Media at the University of Hawaii, and I try to pass on that gift from my father to my students.
And when you do that, what is happening in the Ohina Festival, all the elements of the storytelling that came together, just the theater of the mind your dad created, what sort of tools do you use to pass that inspiration on when you talk to students?
Well, I think it's important to inspire them and make them realize that story is much more than what they tend to think it is. And it begins with trying to let them know that each of them has a story to tell, that their lives are worthy of a great story. And I think that's something that those of us who come from minority cultures, cultures that have been colonized, find it very difficult to do, to recognize that our own stories are worthy. So once they get excited about that, and sometimes you need to take them back to, say, stories that their own parents told them, maybe storybooks at night that mm-hmm. parents told them, and fire up their imagination by taking back to that moment when they first heard these stories and how they were impacted by them. And then from there, I show them examples of great stories, particularly, say, other filmmakers from Hawaii, former students of the Academy for Creative Media who have made films that have been shown at Sundance, for example. And these are ways in which they start becoming aware that if someone who looks like them can make a movie, they too one day might be able to do the same.
Every human being, regardless of background or color or religion or ethnicity, is a thought.
That's
a
right.
thinker, an
That's
individual.
Right. Uh-huh.
You get that in their mind, and is it your idea that visual is better than verbal, or is it a combination of two?
I think both are important. You mm-hmm. know, the Bible tells us that it all begins with the word,
mm-hmm.
and so I think language is just as important, but language combined with the visuals it's twice as powerful. And if you look at film, it's mainly what we see on the screen and what we hear. And what we hear is sometimes music, such as the opening music that you played before the interview, and sometimes it's dialogue. And I think the challenge for the filmmaker is to bring together not just these two elements, but the various talents of other collaborators in filmmaking, such as the cinematographer, the editor, the costume designer, the makeup person. And I think film, to me, is so exciting because it's the most powerful medium we have. It's the most challenging medium, as far as I'm concerned, because all these different elements, and you need so many different talents working together to produce, a work of art.
The almost exponential jump. A story that is heard, the audio is sort of two-dimensional and analog. You get into film, it's three-dimensional. It's an exponential leap.
Right.
So you have all the technical aspects. I noticed in the opening of your film, Mirage, this beautiful visual shot of the ocean going
right.
out. And this would have been tens of thousands of dollars worth of time in the old days, but now something as simple and yet so complex as a drone
right.
has elevated so much
right.
of what the citizen filmmaker can do compared to what the cinematographer did. So do you see any sort of paradox in the balance between bringing it up to everyone, or is it degrading in one sense to the others, or how does that affect?
Well, for poor filmmakers like myself, it's a godsend in uh-huh. that it makes that particular shot much more accessible and available to us. And you're right, without the drone, we would not have been able to shoot that beautiful ocean in the Shangri-La setting from above. But in some ways, because it's easier to produce those shots and because this thing is flying up there, basically on its own, even though somebody else is, of course, controlling it. It sometimes I wonder about the artistry mm-hmm. that goes into the composition of that shot, because in some ways it's almost kind of arbitrary. And sometimes it's a hit or miss, like we shot some of the footage, and it turned out that it wasn't very good because we could see the blade of the, you know, of the drone. So a lot of it was useless. So making it easier doesn't necessarily mean that it's making it better and more artistic.
Well, the films are coming up in the exhibition this Friday, and I want to thank you for all your insight and input, and I would love to see it myself. And I want to thank you so much for being with us on this very windy day.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Bisogni Hironiko was born and raised on Rotuma in the South Pacific. He's now an award-winning playwright, filmmaker, and professor at the University of Hawaii's Academy of Creative Media, where he teaches film production, screenwriting, and film studies. And, of course, the Ohina Festival is this Friday. See our website for more details.
Hawaii Public Radio has the largest newsroom of any radio station in Hawaii, and we produce local programs that make up more than a quarter of what's on our air, and we provide two streams. These are just some of the reasons these Hawaii residents give to their public radio station, and we thank Robert Thomas of Honolulu, Pat Albee of Kamauela, and Laura Pike of Kailua. Mahalo to all of our members who fill us with pride of place every day. You can connect with us on Facebook or find out more at hawaiipublicradio.org. By now, you've no doubt heard that over 6,000 attendees of the IUCN World Conservation Congress are descending on Honolulu's convention center. And while there may be several reality checks of the environment that flow from the 10-day gathering, the first one is how Hawaii landed the conference in the first place. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the story. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, I mean, we know that it was only, what, maybe 2 years ago that this was announced, but it's quite a story how we got to that announcement. Bring us back a little bit.
Well, amazingly, it starts at a taro patch on Maui 8 years ago, and a farmer by the name of Penny Levin was working to restore, that's what she does, the Valley Isles native landscapes, ecosystems. And this was also the time, 2008, when we had the Great Recession, and of course economies were reeling across the planet. Levin was worried that we would lose sight of the importance of conservation efforts, and therefore she started talking to folks that shared similar views, and they said, why don't we try and bring this amazing Congress here? And IUCN, by the way, stands for International Union for Conservation of Nature. And then, of course, it's the World Conservation Congress aspect that's going to be here starting tomorrow. So a pretty big deal for Hawaii starting at a taro patch on Maui.
A big deal for Hawaii and a big deal for the U.S. because we've never hosted this before. I mean, it happens every 4 years, but it's not been here.
Right. Never here before. Well, I know that Neil Abercrombie, when he was governor at the time, approached by stakeholders to try and get this. He said everybody thought it was impossible. There's no way you're going to be able to compete with other nations, because we're really talking about a state competing with other nations. In fact, Turkey was one of those nations that was in the running. But what the governor told me is that really what they did is he started networking with all sorts of folks, not only from local environmental groups, but to the state agencies like the DLNR, Hawaii Tourism Authority, all the way up to the State Department and the White House. We even sent people to Switzerland. That's where the headquarters of the IUCN is, to make our case that Hawaii really would be an excellent place to host this Congress.
Were there certain points that absolutely made that case?
There were a number of things. One, we had hosted APEC successfully in November 2011. President Obama himself wrote a letter to the IUCN noting that and saying, demonstrated that we can hold an international level Congress. As well, as the way the governor put it, Hawaii is kind of a textbook case of all the kind of things that IUCN is focused on. Things like water conservation, protecting endangered species, trying to get off of fossil fuel, trying to get more renewable clean energy strategy. In many ways, it made so much sense. Everything was happening here, right here in an island environment. As well, you could actually go out in the field and actually, you know, visit the forest and visit and see what's being done right on the front lines.
It helps to be the poster state, especially when you have a lot of people who are driving that point home. Thanks, Chad.
Poster state. Good one, Beth.
Well, I'll talk to you tomorrow. We'll have probably much more to say about all this. We're in the neighborhood, and we've been watching lots of people just moving over there to get their registration and pick up their packets over at the convention center. Lots of people milling around this part. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us every day with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The balancing act of manipulating interest rates just enough to keep tabs on inflation has long been the mainstay of federal monetary policy. Since the Great Recession, the Fed has kept interest rates low to spur the economy, and while the recovery it helped support was far less robust than the bounce felt in past recoveries, the real question now is whether low interest rates and low inflation have become the new normal. UH Economic Research Organization Executive Director Carl Bonham joins us now with his take. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
We've talked for a long time about not just where Hawaii is in terms of its recovery, but in general the recovery. And you've said several times this is as good as it's going to get. We've watched, you know, the economy hasn't quite come up to where other, you know, whether other recessions have brought us to, you know, with a recovery afterward. That has been so, felt the impact of what the Fed has done with not raising interest rates, being very, very judicious, and even just a tiny bit that we've seen. Do we have to get used to the fact that maybe we're not going to have this bounce and that there's not going to be this margin to play around with kind of, you know, later when the Fed needs to maybe make some other adjustments?
Well, that's really the main question is, are we now in the new normal of very low growth, very low, possibly even negative, what we call the neutral interest rate, that is the rate where inflation isn't rising and the economy is sort of growing at its potential. Is that the new normal? And the theory or the term that's used to refer to that is secular stagnation, which has been brought back to the fore by Larry Summers. The evidence seems to suggest that that's the case. And you know, you mentioned not getting that bounce that you might have expected after a deep recession. And if you look at the forecasts going back all the way to 2008, they just keep getting lowered, right? So when you're in the early stages of the recessions, you look at people's forecasts for, including the Fed's, forecasts for what GDP growth would be, what job recovery would look like, and what interest rates would look like. They've all been too high, right? And every single year, the forecasts get lowered for the next year. So if you went back and said, look at 08, 09, the Fed's forecast of where interest rates would be right now, their own interest rates that they control, would have been, you know, 1.5% for the Fed funds rate. We're now at less than 0.5%. And so the evidence is sort of increasing that, yes, interest rates are going to be low for a very long period of time, and bond markets think that. The bond market expects the Fed funds rate to not even get to 1% by the end of 2018, which then means that when we hit the next recession, which we will, and the odds are that in the next 2, 3, 4 years we'll see a recession, you won't have the room to cut interest rates that the Fed has typically had, which is a 400 basis point, a 4 percentage point to 5 percentage point decrease in the Fed funds rate.
Every time Janet Yellen speaks, people look at her and are waiting for some indication that there's going to be some incremental, you know, raising of the rates. What does that signal? But even if that were to happen, at this point in time, given the fact that you know we're looking at a recession, maybe in the next 2-3 years, nobody has a crystal ball, but somewhere in that time, then you look at this and say, does it really matter that little tiny bit? I mean, maybe it gives a tiny bit more, but really what I hear you saying is that at some point the Fed's going to be hamstrung, and maybe this is not the way that we need to be approaching monetary policy, that it really is somewhat of a failure.
Well, so the Fed is doing the best that it can. I would argue they shouldn't be raising rates, period, because the risks are not symmetric. The only reason for raising rates is to prevent financial instability through bubbles and to prevent inflation, right? And I would argue there's very little evidence of either of those right now, and that having inflation running at 2, 3, even 4% for a few years is much less of a risk and much less of a problem than the alternative, which is more secular stagnation. In other words, very low growth and continued less than full employment. And so I think, yes, we do tend to sort of latch on to that. I think we will see an interest rate increase before the end of this year. The bigger question is sort of what should the Fed be doing in terms of adjusting expectations about what's possible. And some are arguing that Chris Sims argued at Jackson Hole that they should quit talking about how good they are at these new types of monetary policy, quantitative easing, even negative interest rates around the world. And they should start talking more about how what we need to be looking at is some fiscal policy reform, some structural reform, and things like significant increases in infrastructure investment across the world, not just in the United States. In other words, using fiscal policy to help increase demand. In a world where the developed economies, the governments can borrow at what is effectively a zero or even negative real long-term interest rate. It's impossible to believe that an investment in roads, bridges, schools doesn't earn a return that far exceeds zero. And so there's a real reason to think about those efforts.
That means, though, that that's out of the Fed's hands. That's not something
exactly
the Fed does. So everybody's looking to hear what you just said in the wrong direction.
That's right. And that would be one of the primary arguments of the secular stagnation view, is that there are things that we should be doing that we can do. Well, that we should be doing, we obviously can't do them. In that view, the fiscal austerity and the sequestration that we saw in the United States was about the worst thing that we could have possibly done at the time. And so if people who are making fiscal policy think that the Fed still has tools and that, they're still able to fight slowdowns, which, they fought the slowdown associated with the sequestration, maybe in some way that influences their thinking. I'm not convinced of that. But, yes, there are things that we should be doing now. And one thing we should be doing now is planning for how fiscal policy might react better in a short period of time, because that's one thing that's difficult to do with fiscal policy, is to have stimulus that actually happens quickly.
That's not part of the national narrative that we're hearing at all in this election season, and we haven't really been hearing a lot of that anyway.
That's right. Outside of a very small circle of economists and policymakers, it's really not the discussion.
So, Carl, it sounds like, we're stuck. The thinking is stuck.
There's a lot in the United States will depend on who wins in November. Regardless, if you look at, suppose that Hillary Clinton were to win, she does have plans for increased fiscal spending and increased investments. On the other hand, if the Republicans maintain control, they'll block anything that is proposed. And so the prospects for really well thought out fiscal policy seem fairly dim.
Well, on that happy note, We'll at least have to say goodbye for the moment, but we'll talk about this again, I know. But thanks for coming in and giving a little bit of clarity after we kind of watched what happened in Jackson Hole at the last meeting of the Fed last week. Thanks a bunch. Economics Professor Carl Bonham is the Economic Research Organization's Executive Director. He's also one of its founding members.
John Maynard Keynes.
F.A. Hayek.
Yeah, we're opposed.
We oppose each other philosophically.
In the same studio.
We've been going back and forth for a century.
I want to steer markets.
I want them set free. There's a boom and bust cycle and good reason to fear it. Play low interest rates.
It's the animal spirits.
John Maynard Keynes wrote the book on modern macro. The man you need when the economy's off track. Depression, recession, now your question's in session. Have a seat and I'll school you in one simple lesson.
Aloha, I'm Kyle Itani, chef owner of Hopscotch Restaurant. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Today at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. With the World Conservation Congress in full swing, we're about to find out how citizen scientists get involved in conservation efforts using smartphones, internet access, and data. Aloha, Bert.
Hey, Bill. Good morning.
Good breezy morning. So
This is kind of an interesting time. On the show today, we're going to be talking about citizen science. Another quick topic we're going to be talking about is emergency preparedness, but that's on our news segment. But more importantly, we are hearing a lot about conservation. We're hearing a lot about how we can go about saving the planet. What we're interested on the show is how can the community get involved? You know, there's going to be a lot of experts getting together and talking about, some of their strategic plans. But I think what's happening also at the same time is, you know, this technology that we all have in our fingertips via our smartphone is enabling a lot of folks to get out there and take measurements, take pictures, report back. And I think that's going to really help to move the agenda for conservation.
Seems like the database is now everywhere when we start participating.
Well, you know, the database is everywhere. There's ways of analyzing that data. There's better ways to act on that data. And I think it happens at a much quicker pace now. So I think the efforts to really move forward on some conservation efforts are going to be accelerated. So I think it's an exciting time. I like the idea that, we can all take part in doing something to save our planet.
With our very phone at our very hip. We look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. If you've ever been treated at Kapi'olani Hospital for Women and Children or at Wilcox Memorial Hospital on Kauai, you can thank the Wilcox family for their generosity and far-reaching vision. Abner and Lucy Wilcox arrived in Hawaii in 1837 as missionaries. They moved to Kauai in 1846. As soon as they were settled, Abner began educating the children of Kauai and Niihau at his own expense. His wife, Lucy, bore 8 children, and several of them became important philanthropists. During the construction of Nawiliwili Harbor, the federal funding ran dry. Abner's son, George, saved the day by donating the balance of the money needed to finish the project. Without the port, Kauai would not have been able to sustain its growing population. The Wilcox family made many more contributions, which catapulted Kauai into the 20th century. Of course, no one can do this sort of thing on their own, but it was this one family that set the stage for things to come. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
As Maine Endwell snapped a 5-year championship drought for U.S. teams on Little League's biggest stage, giving the Big Apple its first title since 1964, the news brought to mind another baseball player who found success in New York as a right-handed pitcher. born August 19, 1960 in Honolulu. Our mystery player grew up in Massachusetts and was drafted by the Texas Rangers in the first round of the 1981 amateur draft. He played for several clubs, including the Montreal Expos and the Oakland A's, before landing with the New York Mets. Some of his notable achievements include winning the World Series championship in 1986 and the Rawlings Gold Glove Award in 1989. After a 13-year career on the mound, Ron Darling hung up his pitcher's glove but continued to be a part of the game, providing baseball analysis for TBS, the MLB Network, and other stations.
And Tom Dye of Honolulu knew that answer, called us, and will be the recipient of the HPR T-shirt. It's now coming up to 8:48. That's our quiz. And if you've got one for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Curse that we hear now rehearse in Philadelphia. A second flood, a simple famine, plagues of locusts everywhere, or a cataclysmic earthquake, I'd accept with some despair. But no, you sent us Congress. Good God, sir, was that fair?
Long before the monster hit, Hamilton got America singing about a founding father's take on monetary policy, such as we just discussed in the last segment. There is another show clued into the country's beginnings. Set in the summer of 1776, the colonies are ready to declare independence, if only the founding fathers can agree to do it. 1776 follows John Adams of Massachusetts, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, plus Richard Henry Lee and Thomas Jefferson of Virginia, as they attempt to convince the members of the Second Continental Congress to vote for independence from the shackles of the British monarchy by signing the Declaration of Independence. If this is all news to you, you're not alone, and that's why Polycule Theater is bringing back the musical 1776. Theater manager-producer Tom Holowak joins us this morning. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm fine, Billy. Good to be here.
I courteously agree.
So you know all the inside jokes.
Well, okay, we'll be outside baseball for a while. So it's another generation, the last generation, or probably us, remember when the musical came out, we were hanging around watching the tall ships and the bicentennial celebration. But then Hamilton takes the stage, and now a new generation of Americans are learning about the history. So here you're bringing them back to the history of the history with this musical. What was your inspiration to find so many, shall we say, middle-aged white actors?
Well, it's because it's an election year. Mm-hmm. When I went back and I read some of the lines from 1776 about how Congress was a do-nothing Congress, like that cut you just played, and then found out that really our country was separated even back then. People think that this is something new, and it's not. But the Declaration came about because of compromise. It deals with a number of things that are very important to our country, such as the difference between states' rights and federal rights, and who is going to be in charge. And it actually has three different sides that you hear, and you get to understand why the different colonies thought the different things they did, and how close we came to not having a Declaration of Independence.
And how close was that?
It really required a very tight vote and a bit of cooperation between people. But honestly, the big issue was slavery. People look at the Declaration and they say, well, why didn't they deal with slavery? And the truth is that Jefferson did deal with slavery. It's fascinating to go back and read Jefferson's original draft. And one of the key points of the show is when the representative from South Carolina, Edward Rutledge, basically says that they would be happy to sign it if only they didn't deal with that issue in the Declaration.
Our peculiar institution.
The peculiar institution. And John Adams absolutely does not want to compromise, but it's Ben Franklin who finally says, look, John, if we don't have a declaration signed, then what use is all the rest of it?
The irony is, to us, it's essentially settled law, quote, history, but then nothing was settled, and the fact that we got through it, a lot of things that happened during the Revolutionary War by today's standards appear to be miraculous, like the fog that enabled Washington to escape. And when I look at was the compromise wording up until the year 1808, that wasn't one of the amendments. That was actually written in the Constitution, wasn't it, about slavery?
Exactly. In 1789, they started to deal with the writing of the Constitution. There was a large chunk of time in between there mm-hmm. where we actually had to win the war. People don't realize how drawn out the war was and how it started in Massachusetts, in Lexington and Concord in 1775 yeah. and did not end for years and years.
October 1781, wasn't it?
Exactly. And the Constitution then became the rule book, so to speak. The Declaration was basically just saying, all right, these United Colonies are splitting from their mother country because King George is a tyrant and we deserve it. But the Constitution was really the foundation of our society.
The bugaboo by right ought to be free and independent states. And when you say free and independent, that means the state of New York is independent from the state of South Carolina. Everyone was so completely independent once they had it. And it took, what, about another 3 or 4 years before the last British, after Cornwallis' surrender, even got out of the place. This is pre-telegraphs. I mean, it takes months to get the word around.
It's interesting to go back and look at the original things that Jefferson wrote, besides all the stuff that was taken out, and the show goes into that. I noticed that he originally said the United States of America with a capital U. One of the changes that was made was it was made to a lowercase u. So it was the United States of America, and they equated Great Britain. They called Great Britain a state, not a monarchy. So they basically put them, each state, on the same level as Great Britain, the country. And one of the things that Rutledge says is that they agree to unite for defense, for common defense. But besides that, they declared themselves to be independent countries. I mean, Virginia being founded in 1602, they were called the sovereign country of Virginia.
Well, they still today call it the Commonwealth. Fine distinctions like that. What is a state? What is a commonwealth? I mean, this was very, very critical thinking in those days because they were utterly independent of each other in a sense.
Yeah, it just has to do with the form of legislature they have. Massachusetts is a commonwealth. Pennsylvania is a commonwealth. And Virginia is. And it's... Commonwealth is basically saying for the common good. Mm-hmm. And state doesn't really deal with it like that. But it just is sort of semantics. It's like parishes in Louisiana instead of counties.
But then we have things perish, the thought you have to get to. A play in Hawaii where you have to find middle-aged white guys to play the part. This is not racist. This is actual history. People have to make a fine distinction, right?
Yeah, I've done theater here now for 15 years. And, of course, people who go to shows here know that in Hawaii we have neutral casting, colorblind casting, and that's great. And my fear was that I would have to do that because the crucial issue is about slavery. And even though Hamilton just doesn't care about it. It just throws out the rule book and casts, people who are black and Puerto Rican as the founding fathers. I really wanted to try and do it accurately because I just felt uncomfortable having somebody of color being one of the members of Congress.
But the show itself is going to be a good reflection of your wisdom and thought as one of the founding theatrical fathers of the last 15 years. Tom, it's a delight to see you again. I wish the play all success as I wish the colonies united success.
Thank you, Billy.
Tom Holowak is Palikou Theater Manager. Showtimes are September 2nd to the 18th this year. Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. Sundays at 4 at Windward's Palikou Theater. See our website for more details.
Mr. Adams, I say you should write it. To your legal mind and brilliance we defer.
Is that so? Well, if I'm the one to do it, they'll run their quill pens through it. I'm obnoxious and disliked, you know that, sir.
Yes, I know.
But I say you should write it. Franklin, yes, you.
Hell no.
Yes, you, Dr. Franklin, you.
But.
You.
But.
You.
But.
Listening to you talk to Tom about a musical, I remember that I got to see when I was a kid, and then a lot of people seem to forget about 1776 and after. I mean, with all the
sheer irony is literally students forget. And what was it? Jorge de Santillana said, those who cannot remember history can have to repeat it. It really happened.
It really happened. But the point that I was going to make is that we've seen what has happened with Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the interest in a show that is about someone who, you know, founded our treasury and talked about monetary policy and some of the things, in fact, that we were talking a little earlier with Carl Bonham. And yet it seems not to kind of percolate until there is a great song or there is something that galvanizes attention. And I'm hopeful that maybe 1776 will be able to make a revival.
It may bring it back. As a matter of fact, I had one instance where a guy thought that Hamilton was president because he was on the $10 bill.
Well, we've heard a lot of those such unfortunate references to a history that was made up. But we'll see what happens tomorrow. We won't be making it up. We'll be talking about some of the realities of Hawaii in terms of its agriculture. Hawaii Farmers Union United President Vince Minnah will be here. We'll get an update on what he says, a distinct possibility for us to be able to feed ourselves better.
And Bob Wehrman, the author of Walking Man, The Life of Backpacker Colin Fletcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you miss any part of this show or you want to listen back to a segment, you can always do that by going to our archive. It's on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Just look under The Conversation.
I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning with more of The Conversation.